and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the government shutdown is now in its second month, and no solution appears in sight. As the Trump administration digs in and refuses to budge from its demand for a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, the shutdown is beginning to have serious effects on the overall health of the economy. Next, Reporters Without Borders has condemned the continued detention in the United States of Marzia Hashemi, an American citizen who's a journalist for Iran's Press TV. Hashemi was detained on a material witness warrant to force her to testify before a federal grand jury. That testimony is supposed to take place today. Hashemi has been held in St. Louis and now in Washington since January 13th. Then the European Commission confirmed this morning that a no-deal Brexit would mean a hard border for Ireland. That is, the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland would be like crossing any other international frontier. But the soft border was one of the pillars of the Good Friday Accords that ended the decades-long war in the north of Ireland. Meanwhile, a second referendum that could see Brexit overturned is becoming increasingly possible. And then we continue our regular segment, which we do every Tuesday, called Women in Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. And finally, controversy continues to surround a BuzzFeed article saying that President Trump had specifically ordered his former attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about the Trump Organization's plans to build a residential tower in Moscow in 2016. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team took the unusual step of denying the piece in an embarrassing rebuke to the publication and to the Russiagate narrative overall. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the government shutdown. The shutdown is now in its second month and no solution appears to be in sight as the Trump administration digs in and refuses to budge from its demand for a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. The shutdown is beginning to have serious effects on the overall health of the economy. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, as well as a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to the London Review of Books, The Nation, Extra, Tarbell, and Salon.com. Welcome back, Dave.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Dave, we talk a lot about people not getting their paychecks and missing mortgage payments. We talk about people not getting their food stamps on time. But let's talk about a bigger, broader issue. And that is that this thing has dragged on so long that we're now in danger of the economy being pushed into recession. Tell us about that.
Well, I don't know how soon the risk comes, but there are so many complex wheels and gears that are part of the economy that when the federal government, which plays a huge role in as an economic driver, that things depend on the, like as you mentioned, the mortgages have to be insured by the Fannie Mae and Ginny Mae and so on. And so when they can't get the mortgages supported by those agencies, which can't run right now, then that's one segment, huge segment of the economy. The building, construction work and the buying and selling of property can't happen. That's huge. But you can imagine a whole bunch of these things that are tied to the U.S. government. If people don't get their food stamps, then, the smaller grocery stores that depend a lot on food stamp customers start running out of money. And that all these things snowball. And then ultimately, the biggest one is the impact it could have on interest rates if you get to a point where the government has to make payments on the debt, which is huge. $21 trillion debt has a lot of interest. And if the government can't pay its bills, then interest rates will go up because borrowers will look at U.S. debt as riskier. Last time there was a major block in passing a budget, the U.S. debt rating, which used to be the highest, like a AAA, went down a notch to, I think it was AA+ or something. Well, that's a huge impact on everything economic because every interest rate is tied to that. So you can see where this will start to go off the rails at some point. And I'm not a, seer. Economic seer, I can't tell you when it starts to go off the rails, but if you've ever seen a train go off the tracks, It's kind of a slow motion catastrophe. It, like, first one car goes, and then they're all connected, and so it starts to pull down the whole train. And you see this sort of gradual effect of the whole thing tipping over on its side, and nothing can stop it. You know, once the engine goes off the rails, it starts pulling all the other ones off. And that's kind of how an economy can work with, you know, with this sort of thing.
Yeah. What do you think of the president's offer this weekend? He's made a couple of offers. So far, the Democrats just say they're dead on arrival. And I think the key really is Mitch McConnell, because Mitch McConnell won't even allow anything to go to a vote in the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting phenomenon that, you know, normally the procedure in government is that the Congress passes bills, and then the bills go to the president to sign, and then the president either says that he's going to sign it, or he either pocket vetoes it by not signing it, or actually signs a veto and sends it back to them. Either way, Congress can override a veto with a two-thirds vote. So the usual procedure is that Congress acts and then sees what the president does. What the Republicans have been doing for years now, while they've been in control of one or both houses, is deciding whether, is sort of in league with the president, whether to submit a bill that the president will sign. And they won't even put a bill to the president that the president won't sign. And I'm not a historian. I can't go back and tell you whether Democrats have done that too, but I don't think so. It's not the normal procedure that we've seen through history. They're somewhat co-equal branches, and Congress does what it wants and then sees what the president does, and then if enough people want it passed, they can pass it.
Dave Lindorf, let's talk about what Trump specifically offered in his televised address on Saturday. He said that in return for getting the $5.7 billion he's demanding for the wall, that he would give up to 700,000 Dreamers, those are young kids or were young kids who came to the United States without papers, without legal documents, with their families, and today are adults or older teenagers and still are undocumented. Obama had provided them relief. They weren't going to be deported. They could get work permits. They could get driver's license. They could have normal lives. Trump took that back as an executive order. He also took back by executive order the TPS, the temporary protected status for Haitians, Salvadorans, and others. What Trump was offering was to give 3 years of relief, of guarantees, no deportation for the Dreamers, and also an extension for the people on TPS, temporary protected status, in exchange for it. And the Democrats initially said, okay, that's hostage taking. We're not going to deal with that. Do you think the Democrats will stick to their guns?
I think they will, because people understand that the polls show that people understand that this is, like you're saying, hostage taking, that you can't really run a government where every time the president wants something, he can just freeze up the budget. I think there's a recognition that if the Democrats were to cave on an offer like that, which isn't that great an offer, by the way, with a 3-year deadline, it just pushes it down the road a little, then it'll just lead to more of these, you know, hostage takings of the budget.
Yeah. And again, just for people, as you're pointing out, John, Congress, according to the Constitution, has the power of the purse. The power to declare war. They don't do that anymore, not since 1941. They have the power of the purse. Those are their two. Otherwise, it's just purely a talk shop, which apparently it is.
Yeah, and it's funny to me that so many members of the legislature think that their job is just to help prop up a president, whether it's Donald Trump or Barack Obama before him. When I was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff, we were under strict orders never to undertake an investigation that could potentially embarrass the White House. And that's just not the way government should operate.
It's totally antithetical to the concept of having a legislative and an executive branch. That's why we don't have, by the way, what a lot of governors have, a line item veto. As Congress has never given the president a line item veto, because that takes away legislative power entirely. If you can pass a budget and then the president can say, well, I'm approving this part of it, but not that part of it. So it's still, you know, one of the last powers of Congress is that when they give the president a bill, that's it. It's all of the above or nothing.
And these 535 people who talk, continue to get paid, while all the other government workers are not getting paid and private contractors. And by the way, all those people, the furloughed employees, are trying to get second jobs, even temporary jobs. They're not getting hired because nobody wants to hire them here in Washington or around the country, because as soon as the government does come back, they'll be gone. So they're really stuck.
Yeah, they really are. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, as well as a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to the London Review of Books, The Nation, Extra, Tarbell, and Salon.com. Stay tuned. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Reporters Without Borders has condemned the continued detention in the United States of Marzia Hashemi, an American citizen who's a journalist for Iran's Press TV. Hashemi was detained on a material witness warrant to force her to testify before a federal grand jury. That testimony is supposed to take place today. Hashemi was held in St. Louis and now in Washington since January 13th. We're joined from London by Narges Mobaleghi. She's an independent journalist and a friend and former colleague of Marzia Hashemi. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We're confused here in the United States, most of us anyway, who follow these issues, as to why in the world the federal government would issue a material witness warrant. Now, a material witness warrant means you are placed essentially under arrest. They don't call it arrest. They call it detention. You're taken to a jail cell, and you are not allowed to leave until they force you to testify before a grand jury. Why do you think Marzia was caught up in something like this?
Well, that is, as they say, the million-dollar question, isn't it? And you might be confused in the United States. People all around the world who know Marzia, whether personally or through her work like me, or, you know, viewers from around the world, they're asking that same question. She's been incarcerated since the 13th of January now, and we have more questions than we did to begin with, and still very little answers. We know now that she's being detained without charge under this very controversial material witness law. But why? We do not know. There are no details about what this grand jury is about. Very little details coming out at all. The children still don't know. The children are now subpoenaed to appear as well. All three children. I mean, these are, it's really unprecedented. And really very, very dangerous, and setting a very dangerous precedent for journalism at a time, of course, in America, where we look, the world now looks at the Donald Trump presidency and his daily attacks, vicious attacks at the mainstream press, let alone how a journalist such as Marzia, who makes her own individual choice to work for, you know, an organization that's not in the mainstream press, might be treated. So it's really very worrying, really worrying signals. Of course, we don't actually know what is happening, so we have to be cautious what we say. What we're saying is there are very many questions, some really dangerous indicators. The family is really concerned for Marzia. You know, there was these awful civil and religious rights abuses at the in the beginning days of her incarceration. They're worried about her health. Marzia is almost 60. She has heart palpitations that require medication. She's fainted before, once on air, because she'd been working so hard and she'd skipped a meal. So for her children to hear that she's under in a very stressful situation, being incarcerated, not knowing why, and that she hasn't been given food because they refused her vegetarian and halal options, and that she'd told her daughter in the first phone call on Tuesday that she'd only had a cracker to eat since being incarcerated since Sunday. So I think the story is moving forward, and of course it's becoming more complex. But at the same time, we shouldn't forget that those really severe violations that she told her daughter about in those first few days of her incarceration. Her children say they believe it was the media coverage and the outpouring of support from communities around the world that made the authorities stand up, kind of prick their ears up and change the situation. She's now being given a hijab, and she is now getting what she called in her second, there's only been two phone calls, in her second phone call to Sarah, her daughter, she said, well, I'm being given food to get by. And when I spoke to Sarah, Sarah said, well, I don't know what that means, but she said she's being given food to get by now, and she does have a hijab. But why was she left for, it seems, at least 72 hours, if not more?
I have to add to that, there are prisoners in American federal prisons who are in solitary confinement who have more rights and more freedom than what Marzia Hashemi is going through right now. Even if you're in solitary confinement, you get a phone call a week and you're allowed to see your attorney whenever your attorney wants or needs to see you. She's not even getting those basic freedoms, and she's not under arrest.
And for our audience, we're on two Washington, D.C. stations every day, Monday through Friday, 105.5 FM, 1390 AM, and other stations around the country as the evening goes on. For most Americans who don't know about the material witness law and don't know about Marzia, she is a very, very well-known person. That's number one. Two, she's an African-American, a person who came to St. Louis on her break from work at Press TV. She was going to make a documentary movie about Black Lives Matter when she was arbitrarily arrested. And third, she's being held because the government uses the material witness law to hold her indefinitely, really, so that they can compel her testimony. But they don't necessarily need to arrest somebody to have them come and speak at a grand jury. You could subpoena them. And so you can't put these facts together. The U.S. hostility towards Iran, the Trump administration's hostility towards the media, including the alternative media, her arbitrary arrest, the fact that she was held in such terrible conditions. You can't put all that together and not come to the conclusion that what the U.S. government is really trying to do is to break this journalist so that in order to gain her basic rights, including her freedom, that she'll somehow be compelled to do something that the U.S. government wants her to do. In other words, we have a Kafkaesque situation here, and it's important for people who believe in freedom of the press, who believe that the government should not be arresting journalists, to take a stand right now.
I think, of course, one of the unfortunate things and very frustrating things, as somebody who's worked in the alternative media, and I should say I know Marzia from working at Press TV myself in Tehran for several years, and we've stayed in touch since then. And now I was counting when this happened, and I realized it's been 11 years that I've known her, so I've known her for a long time. But what can actually be very frustrating when you're a journalist that might not choose mainstream options for work is that disparity in how cases like this are dealt with, because they should be dealt with on the principle of the matter and not the politics of the matter. But unfortunately, even very much across the board of our journalistic colleagues in the international media and the mainstream media, we are seeing, I think, a disparity comparative to if this was a journalist who was working for another outlet that happened to be somewhere else in the world, even if that outlet was state-owned. And we've seen examples of that. And I think, though I don't work for Press TV anymore, and I have, you know, there are criticisms of Press TV, some of which I agree with. I think that is really unfair. Press TV journalists doing their job and doing really important work, journalists like Serena Shim, another American citizen who was killed in very mysterious circumstances whilst investigating, if I'm not mistaken, Daesh or ISIS arms going from Turkey into Syria. And she was threatened by Turkish authorities and then was dead within 48 hours. And there, I mean, many of your listeners might not have even heard of her before. But this was, you know, her mother was white American. She was American born. She was a journalist. Her mother was campaigning and begging, at the time, Barack Obama to just pay attention to this American journalist who had been killed. So I think that can be really frustrating, because I know Marzia, I've spoken to her so much. I know how important African-American issues are to her and why, in a way, she had a path away from working on the mainstream. You know, her daughter was telling me an anecdote that Marzia, as a journalism graduate, she's a journalism graduate from an American university, and her daughter was telling me that actually she became Muslim and started wearing the hijab. shortly after graduating, and she had job offers that were taken away from her because she was wearing the hijab. And this would have been, I assume, in the early 80s. So this was a black woman who became Muslim, who had to face the racism, the Islamophobia, not just of the last 10 years or not just since 9/11, but, you know, historically, and these issues were important to her. She was a politically aware person. She took a route, I think, that she felt would allow her to discuss the issues that are important to her with freedom and in a way that she feels fits how she wants to cover them. And it's really frustrating to then see that something like this can happen to her and you're not getting that mass movement that you might get otherwise as a mainstream.
Do you have any sense about what this grand jury investigation or grand jury case is about?
When I say that family literally have no clue on the specifics when it comes to this case, but of course, we know in general how material witness laws have been used, especially when it comes to detaining Muslims. I think you both could speak on that much better than I could. But certainly hearing from what the ACLU, from Human Rights Watch, from what I understand, even American courts at times have ruled that it is being used unconstitutionally and that there is a disparity on Muslims, especially Muslim males, ending up in the system in what in his essence a fishing expedition. And it's, so it's very worrying to think that that might be happening. Now, of course, if it happens to anybody, that is awful. But Marzi is a journalist. So I think that has a dynamic to it that is, you know, I don't want to say that that makes it more awful than another person. It's the same. But it is an affront to freedom of the press on top of all the other discriminations that, you know, as I said, top United States organizations have critiqued the material witness law about. But
yeah, in terms of the critique, we're rapidly running out of time, John, but the material witness law has been challenged over and over again. As our guest was mentioning, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2009 ruled on behalf of one of the plaintiffs, one of the victims of the material witness law. But then it was overturned later by the Supreme Court. So right now it stands. And we know that Mueller, who was then head of the FBI, rounded up literally thousands of Muslims and Arab Americans and South Asians after 9/11 under the material witness law, kept people indefinitely many times. Anyway, as we go out, I just wanted to mention to people who are in the Washington, D.C. area, at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, that's tomorrow, there's going to be people gathering in support of this journalist that's going to be on Constitution Avenue and 3rd Street at the Federal District Court building.
We will leave it there. We were joined from London by Narges Mubalighi. She is an independent journalist and a friend and former colleague of Marzia Hashemi. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The European Commission confirmed this morning that a no-deal Brexit would mean a hard border for Ireland. That is, a border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland that would be like crossing any other international frontier. But the soft border was one of the pillars of the Good Friday Accords that ended the decades-long war in the north of Ireland. Meanwhile, a second referendum that could see Brexit overturned is becoming increasingly possible. We'll discuss all of that with Andy Brennan. He's a journalist with Asia Times and CGTN, and he joins us from Beijing. Welcome back, Andy.
Hi, glad to be back.
Andy, I was in the UK this weekend, and I was struck by how literally no one had any idea how this was going to play out. Even on the televised news, politicians of every stripe were saying everything from they're going to work it out, to there's going to be a no-deal Brexit, to there's going to be a second referendum. But nobody really knows. Tell us what you think.
Like everybody else, I don't know, because it's just unheard of. It's unseen. I would start by saying that I really think the Conservative and Unionist Party, otherwise known as the Tory Party, at this stage is just being, on the whole, downright selfish. It's driven largely by ideological fear from allowing a Labour government in. Theresa May, who's the Prime Minister, her intransigence on her deal, the Tories' incalculable fear. It's all just spinning into a deadlock situation, which is going nowhere. just because they don't want a European socialist democratic government getting into power. I think May has really played party politics to her detriment. She pandered to hardliners for too long when she wasn't that hard. And the Tories are now, like, they are damaging their own country. Now, at the same time, Labour voters, when the referendum, the Brexit referendum originally happened, a lot of them voted also to leave because they were angry. They were angry because, one example would be, Britain had lost like millions of industrial jobs, manufacturing jobs, all the way down, I think, from somewhere in the region of 8 million to 2 million. It had become a financialized economy going through the City of London. Former Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, said, quoted a report recently saying that as much as £120 billion is annually siphoned out of Britain and avoids tax for the wealthy. And for example, Jeremy Corbyn is adamant that he would stop this. But now grassroots supporters on the Labour side actually want a second referendum because there's such confusion, there's such chaos, and they really didn't know how this would pan out. And today, for example, being Tuesday, there is a lot of motions going ahead in the House of Commons. Former Attorney General Dominic Greaves is leading one group who is trying to give six options to the Commons and to gain power over the Conservative government. Another MP, Yvette Cooper, is trying to get a motion passed which will extend the negotiations by 9 months. So basically, the Parliament is turning on itself and every faction is trying to take control. And where this can go with the clock ticking down to the 29th of March is anybody's guess. But on the 30th of March, a new report came out just yesterday, citing that from the customs border, saying that anywhere between 75 and 83% of customs would drop on the first day. They call it no deal day one. That's how bad the trade would get. It would just drop significantly. And that's just shocking.
I want to know, too, your thoughts on the notion of a second referendum. Even people who support a second referendum say that they're not quite sure what the legal path to it is. How do you see that playing out?
I'm not sure myself, but I do know Jeremy Corbyn has now endorsed a plan for a second referendum. This is reported by the Daily Telegraph, Britain's Daily Telegraph, following months of pressure from some Labour MPs and the grassroots. If the MPs have a final say on it. So it's a shift in his position because some people think that he prefer to be out of the EU, which is, you know, his own personal choice. So if the majority of the MPs in the Commons backed it, the Parliament could force the Prime Minister to hold a second referendum, even though Theresa May keeps ruling it out. I don't know if it's necessarily the best course of action. For example, I'm from Ireland and the EU needs reforms. It does, but it does a great deal of good things too. It's done a lot for Ireland. It really has. But it's better to have one foot in the door to be able to make those reforms and make it more democratic than being outside it, not being able to execute any change. But having a second referendum, I don't know, is it the fairest thing? Because what happens to the legitimacy of the first and when does it stop? This argument does have some merit. I don't see how it's going to come about easily, only from public pressure or an overturning of the Conservative government by the Commons, which isn't impossible or improbable in any case, the way it's going.
Andy Brennan is our guest. Andy is a journalist with Asia Times and CGTN. He joins us from Beijing. Andy, you're from Ireland. You are, where in Ireland did you grow up?
So I grew up on a county called Galway, which is directly on the west. Next stop from Galway is Canada. So it's in the Republic, as some people may know. So that would be called the old term, the South, but basically Republic of Ireland.
Let's talk, Andy, about what a hard border would mean between Northern Ireland, the six counties of the north that are still part of the UK, a colonial legacy, and the Republic of Ireland, given the Good Friday Accords that finally brought most of the military conflict to an end, the war in Northern Ireland to an end, that required that there be basically a soft border, a border whereby people could go freely or almost freely between the Republic of Ireland and the northern part of Ireland. Talk about what a hard border would mean. Would it mean a return to military operations by the IRA or some wing of the IRA?
So I actually have a lot to say about this. So just on a personal note first, I remember when I was 7 years old, I was one night in Galway in a swimming center, and it was 1997, and there was a bomb scare. And a bomb scare was called in by a paramilitary force, and the parents freaked out. I was just seven swimming with all my friends. Our parents jumped over the seats. They ran down, they grabbed us, and they dragged us out of the swimming center. My uncle worked for the Irish government as a civil servant, and one time he was threatened with a bomb under his car. I remember once driving up to Belfast to my mom's friend and going through military checkpoint after military checkpoint after military checkpoint. It's possible to return to it. Now, it doesn't mean that it can return to it because things have changed, and thankfully. But for example, just a few days ago, there was a perilous thought sent out almost to test the waters before Theresa May herself shut it down. And that report was from somebody. It was somebody, be a civil servant, a Brexiteer, but they reported, we might like to renegotiate the Good Friday Agreement. That is incredibly dangerous. It is so insensitive. The flippancy towards that is so perilous. Like, this agreement is the perennial conflict resolution political framework in the world, I would think. And yet it's far from perfect. I said to you before, and the first time I came on, that having a hard border return would instantly galvanize the nationalist Republican paramilitaries, the dissident side who haven't gone through the political process, and such as the Provisional IRA members in Sinn Féin, which has been very successful because the border region is dominated on definitely by more so in the Irish community, and any infrastructure would galvanize them. Now, we just saw in Derry City, which is the second largest city in Northern Ireland and would be the third largest city or fourth on the island of Ireland, had a car bomb. That has not been seen in some time. And Derry City is right next to the border, just like Enniskillen in Fermanagh and Newry and Armagh. These are border regions, and that's why I said it would start first. Now, the assistant constable of the PSNI, Mark Hamilton, said he didn't believe that this was linked to Brexit, but many, many people believe it does. Now, a lot of Derry don't want this to happen. There's no taste for it at all. They're very much against it, thankfully. And greatly. But the new IRA, for example, are a dissident paramilitary group. They're a merger of the INLA, which is the Irish National Liberation Army, and the Real IRA, which is a splinter group from the Provisionals. Their membership was known mostly to security services, but they've become better and better and have renewed their tactics again after being weakened for so long. Their members are less well known. They have a few hundred members. They are getting their hands on newer weaponry, reports say. They reject the North's peace process, and they never decommission their weapons. They want to end the British presence in the North. They demand that the North leaves the UK and reunites with the Republic. In 2018, which was last year, the new IRA was carried out, is believed, up to 24 punishment shootings in the North. The violence, it included the murder of a prominent drug dealer in a joint attack by the new IRA and another associated group called the Army of the Republic, which is, again, linked all to the Real IRA, which just created this new group. They also led three nights in July of 2018, violence and a street campaign in Derry as a recruitment exercise. It was announced by the PSNI. They had over 30 bomb blasts and at least three IEDs. They're not amateurs. They're dangerous, and they're getting good again. People forget that the Provisional IRA at the height was one of the most successful guerrilla fighting forces of the 20th century. It trained with the PLO, it trained in Libya, it trained with Al-Qaeda, it trained FARC. They're not stupid. They've just been weakened. And it's very dangerous. They have access to AK-47s. They had access to Semtex. Some people believe they have that back. A report was in the Irish media last year that about 5 years ago, there was a cargo ship carrying in a loaded container contraband that the new IRA uses to fund its weaponry, but it was destroyed by Al-Qaeda because there was a ship that was passing through the Suez Canal. That was a report that came out. They use they're restocking their weaponry because their main income is smuggling cigarettes, alcohol across the border, perfume. They, I think, even design clothes, and they have legitimate front businesses.
Well, we will continue following that story. That was the voice of Andy Brennan. He joined us from Beijing. Andy is a journalist with Asia Times and CGTN. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our regular segment, which we do every Tuesday, called Women in Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. Hannah Dickinson is a professor and she's an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. She joins us from Geneva, New York. Welcome back.
Thanks so much, John.
Well, there was so much in the news this past week, Hannah, but one of the biggest stories was a series of marches, and they were sort of juxtaposed with each other. We had the Women's March, which was massive and nationwide, and we had the march that comes annually to protest the Roe v. Wade decision. Let's start by talking about that.
Yeah, so Friday was the March for Life, coinciding this year with the 46th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. And I wanted to start just by talking a little bit about Roe v. Wade. It's, of course, incredibly important to women's bodily autonomy and healthcare. But of course, the court case is just one small piece of the fight for bodily autonomy for women in the U.S. And as we talked about a few weeks ago, just because abortion is legal in the U.S., it doesn't mean that women are actually able to access this right. It's always been the case, even before Roe, that women of means could access abortion with far more ease than poor women. And so part of what we're seeing from the right and have seen over the last 46 years is a constant attempt to whittle away at the rights of women guaranteed under the law, right? From things like the defunding of Planned Parenthood, to the Hyde Amendment, to the violent targeting of abortion providers, to what we're seeing now with both the criminalization of pregnancy and criminalization of pregnant women, I should say, and a criminalization of women who seek abortion. So the situation, unfortunately, is pretty dire right now, despite a strong grassroots fight back.
Hannah Dickinson, let's talk about how abortion rights basically have been extinguished for, I don't know how many women, but for, I would say, maybe 30% to 50% of the country. Abortion is essentially inaccessible, unreachable, except under extraordinary hardship for working class and poor women. I mean, it's everywhere. Ultimately, you know, when Roe v. Wade was passed by, it was during the Nixon era, it was at a time when women were in the streets. I mean, the court, although still had many conservative members on it, voted for abortion rights. But the context was women in the streets. I'm not talking about in the thousands. I'm talking about in the hundreds of thousands. And not just in the streets, but in every place that you went in America at that time, including within leftist organizations. Women were asserting themselves, asserting their leadership, challenging patriarchal notions. You couldn't go anywhere in American society without this issue becoming the issue or one of the big issues, along with civil rights for the African American community. Anyway, let's put it into some historical context.
Yes. So I'm glad that you mentioned the relationship between the civil rights struggle and the struggle for women's bodily autonomy, because reproductive justice means that all women should have the freedom to choose whether and when to have children. And that was the demand of the women fighting before Roe v. Wade that helps make Roe v. Wade possible. Let's not forget that this country has a long history of sterilizing Indigenous women, Black women, and disabled women. We are seeing now increased criminalization of pregnancy, especially for women who struggle with addiction or live day to day with domestic violence. So a meaningful reproductive justice framework isn't just about women being able to access abortion, but really is about women being able to make the decision about whether and when to have children. And not just wealthy women, not just able-bodied women, not not just white women. And those were the early demands, right? I read an interesting article about women organizing in Austin, Texas, before Roe v. Wade, where they, next to their radical newspaper headquarters, had a payphone where women would call to describe where they'd been able to access abortion so other women could learn about those possibilities. And so it's that kind of fight back that makes Roe v. Wade possible, but also is necessary in the current times where, despite the fact that abortion, legal abortion, is the law of the land, we're seeing some incredible crackdowns on those rights. There are 7 states that have only one abortion provider in the entire state. And as we saw with Ohio, and I expect we'll see legislation coming out of Kentucky and a few other states, an attempt to make abortion illegal after 6 weeks when women often don't even know they're pregnant. So the reactionary pushback began immediately after Roe and has become increasingly powerful. Vice President Pence spoke at the March for Life this year, as he has done every year since becoming vice president. And it's kind of an unprecedented thing there. And I just wanted to mention one of his remarks, in addition to telling the right that they had every reason to be optimistic about an end to abortion, which in and of itself is pretty gross. He also claimed in his speech that life is winning in America. Which just begs the question, right? Whose lives are winning? It's definitely not the lives of migrant children dying at the border. It's not the lives of Black children being gunned down by police, not the lives of domestic violence victims or homeless children abandoned by the government shutdown. Certainly not the lives of women who the far right believes should sacrifice their own lives for a fetus that is growing inside of them. It all feels pretty disingenuous. And I'll just add one more thing, as we saw with the sort of gang of white boys in MAGA hats who were harassing a Native man after the March for Life rally. We can see the ways that misogyny and an attempt to control women's bodies is always co-productive with settler colonialism and white supremacy in America. And, the fight for reproductive justice must be a fight for reproductive justice for all women and for an insistence that a sort of new regime or an attempt of a return to a regime of white male dominance over all of society has to be fought against.
Yeah. Professor Dickinson, one, I'm glad you mentioned the incident with these Catholic school teenage boys here in Washington, D.C. The entire controversy has been around the confrontation that they had with this individual indigenous man down on the mall. And Covington Catholic High School from Northern Kentucky, a suburb of Cincinnati, has hired a PR firm, and they're now spinning the story. The students have been treated like victims now. They say that the media carried out a character assassination against them, et cetera, et cetera. The thing that's almost completely missing from the discussion is that this Catholic private high school sent these boys, these teenage boys wearing their, Make America Great hats again, to lobby, to march against, to rally against women's rights. Like, that seemed to be like okay with everybody, that these boys could come and try to demand that women be denied their rights, and that the only issue was whether or not they treated these other people, including the people on the mall, including this indigenous man who was obviously a victim of them. The whole issue was about that confrontation, but not about the confrontation that they came to start, which is against women.
I'm glad you framed it that way, Brian. It's been really frustrating for me to watch as well, that it seems like there's some sense that it's a guaranteed right for young men to be both racist and chauvinist in these really violent ways. There's some video that just came out this morning of perhaps the same boy, perhaps some other boys at the March for Life rally chanting, "It's not rape if you like it." So, it doesn't doesn't take a large stretch of the imagination. And I mean, when we saw this with Kavanaugh too, right? To understand that the kind of right to dominance, right? Right to do what they want, say what they want, be as violent as they want among a really small segment of the population had outsized effects, right? On people of color, on women, on indigenous people, on our environment. It's that kind of patriarchal dominance endangering the world.
The thing also is the language of this. The right to life, the, I would say, semi-fascist assault against women's rights to control their own bodies and decide to have children or not to have children, they frame it as the right to life. And so now the framing in the mass media is, are you for the right to life or the right to choose? Again, this is a fundamental vicious assault against women, including leading to the death of women, framed as a life to right. I mean, we have to strip that language out and expose it for what it is. Go ahead.
That's exactly right. There was a really neat protest on Sunday where an organization projected on the side of Trump Tower, abortion is freedom. And that's right, right? For one in four women will have an abortion in their lifetime. And they're making that decision because, of course, women should be free to make choices about when and if they have children. And the idea that that could be stripped away by, again, a small number of men looking for some increased control and dominance over women is really disgusting, right? Women should absolutely have the freedom to choose what to do with their bodies, and that includes having children, it includes access to healthcare, it includes being free from gender-based violence, it includes access to trans healthcare, right? These are all important components of reproductive justice framework that insists that women should have as much control over of their own bodies as men have over theirs.
There it is. That was the voice of Hannah Dickinson. She's a professor and an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. She joined us from Geneva, New York. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Controversy continues to surround a BuzzFeed article saying that President Trump had specifically ordered his former attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about the Trump Organization's plans to build a residential tower in Moscow in 2016. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team took the unusual step of denying the piece in an embarrassing rebuke to the publication and to the Russiagate narrative overall. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
So, Daniel, walk us through this. You've got BuzzFeed and two very aggressive, well-known journalists who come out with this explosive story. And then the special counsel takes the very unusual step of coming out and denying it. Then over the weekend, one of the journalists and the BuzzFeed editor double down, and they go on CNN and MSNBC and PBS and elsewhere to say that they're sticking by their story, that they actually are developing additional information that further confirms the story. And all the while, the White House and the general counsel's office say it's just not true.
Well, I mean, first of all, so the story is a big story because it says that the Trump instructed Cohen, his lawyer Cohen, to lie to Congress about the Moscow Trump Tower deal. And if it's true, you know, telling somebody, you know, suborning perjury is clearly a high crime and misdemeanor. Was one of those high crimes and misdemeanors the Constitution says is a prerequisite for impeachment. So it's really seemed, if this story was true, that Trump was finally at last going down. And a lot of people jumped on it, the New York Times, CNN, et cetera, you know, saying like, you know, shouting hallelujah, at last we have the smoking gun, at last Trump is, you know, is halfway out the door, you know, thank God, so on and so forth. And then came Mueller's denial. And there was a lot of egg on a lot of faces. And although BuzzFeed is sticking with the story, I mean, everyone else is running away from it as fast as they can. But the point is that this has happened time and time again. on Twitter, a Canadian pastor and video maker named Doug Johnson Hatlam has cataloged a list of more than 50 Russiagate stories that have not panned out. More than 50. I mean, that includes everything from the Guardian's, super sensational front page splash that that Paul Manafort had secret talks with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy, the Russians hacked Vermont's electric grid. CNN reported that there was a Russian investment fund had secret ties to top officials. When that turned out to be false, a reporter and two editors got canned. There was reports that Russia hacked Emmanuel Macron's emails, that Trump had prior knowledge of the famous Trump Tower meeting in June 2016 to get dirt on Hillary, so on and so forth, ad infinitum. Now, this is just going on and going on. And as soon as one story is knocked down, the press comes back with another story. So, and that gets knocked down as well. And the same thing happens again and again and again. I mean, clearly the truth doesn't matter. I mean, Trump, yeah, is an expert when it comes to fake news, but the media has got is copying him and is retailing fake news of its own. And this keeps on going on. It's astonishing.
And one of the crazy things to me is that these different news outlets have taken a position. And depending on what their position is on the broader Russiagate narrative, that's what their response is to the BuzzFeed article. CNN, for example, I was surprised at Ali Velshi last night at the vociferousness with which he was attacking BuzzFeed. In fact, he wouldn't even allow the editor to completely answer a question. Just as he would begin answering, he would be interrupted and couldn't finish his thought.
Yes, they are so highly invested in this story. They swallowed the Clinton line, hook, line, and sinker that Trump was somehow under the control of the Russians, either through bribery or blackmail, and that and therefore they swallowed that line and they have stuck to it ever since. And they've tried to come up with facts to fit their thesis, but this is the exact opposite. This is the exact opposite of what they teach you in journalism school, which is to be disinterested, to follow the facts, not to tailor the facts to fit your story. It's ludicrous. And yet this is happening again and again, and the cycle is repeated again and again. It's like you're dealing with a falling down drunk who, sobers up on Friday, and then when the evening comes, he's back in the bar and getting soused again.
Again, let's listen to the spokesman for Mueller, Peter Carr. He said these words about BuzzFeed's article. Again, this is so extraordinary. Mueller hardly ever speaks. The Mueller probe hardly ever speaks. They certainly don't do things like deny it. But this story had become such a big deal because, as Daniel Lazar is pointing out, if true that Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, had been directed by Donald Trump himself to lie to Congress, to obstruct the Russian investigation in any way, that would be an impeachable offense. That was such a big deal, and it was being treated by the media as 100% the smoking gun at last. And here's what Mueller's spokesman says. BuzzFeed's description of specific statements to the special counsel's office and characterization of documents and testimony obtained by this office regarding Michael Cohen's congressional testimony are not accurate. Now, BuzzFeed then went on and said, well, they didn't tell us what parts were not accurate,
right,
as if that's the defense. Again, Mueller would not have done this except but for the fact that it's not true, but because it became such a dominant story, it was going to lead to a chorus demanding impeachment or other action.
And in fact, on CNN yesterday, the BuzzFeed editor said that the Mueller team statement was a non-denial denial, because they didn't specifically say which sentence, which thought, which part was incorrect. And that just wasn't it at all.
To me, that's crazy. And by the way, the Guardian has not retracted its Manafort Assange story either. By the way, and which Politico.com tried to blame on Russia, on Russian disinformation. Ludicrous. I want to emphasize that a few people got it right, one of which is Alan Dershowitz, for example, who published a piece in the posted a piece on the New York Daily News website picking apart the BuzzFeed story. Another was Aaron Maté, a Russiagate skeptic who writes for The Nation and other publications, who also put out a Twitter blast dissecting BuzzFeed. And a third, not last but not least, is Sputnik Radio.
This show with you, Daniel Lazaro, because you said people should be, this was before the denial came out from Mueller. You, Daniel Lazar, said people need to be very, very skeptical about this story. Go ahead.
As far as I'm concerned, these stories are up there with supermarket tabloid tales of alien abductions. I mean, maybe those are true too, right? But they have as much credibility as these ongoing sensational Russiagate revelations do. But they keep coming just the same as the supermarket tabloids keep pumping out articles about aliens and lonely housewives in New Hampshire.
And as we mentioned, Daniel, on the show, Jason Leopold has gotten story after story after story wrong. Fired by Salon in 2002. He said Karl Rove was going to be indicted in 2006. That turned out not to be true. Again, BuzzFeed published a story, this was in 2017, by Jason Leopold about wire transfers from the Russian government to Russian embassies in August 2016. That would have been 3 months before the U.S. election, that were accompanied by memos saying that the funds were to, quote, finance the election campaign of 2016, close quote. And Jason Leopold made the point that this showed proof positive that Russia was meddling in the U.S. 2016 election, but that was also at the same time that Russia was holding parliamentary elections, and Russians who were overseas, like in the United States, could vote at Russian embassies. So the $30,000 that had been transferred by the Russian Foreign Ministry to its embassy here was to set up the polling and the electioneering for the Russian election. But nonetheless, that was treated by the mainstream media after a Jason Leopold story as good coin until it turned out to be, in fact, 100% not true.
Jason Leopold published a memoir in which he admitted to, quote, lying, cheating, and backstabbing, unquote, said he had battled mental illness and struggled with substance abuse. Now, I don't want to give Leopold a hard time, but the fact is that he has an extremely checkered journalistic record. And so, therefore, I mean, BuzzFeed should be checking out what he writes very carefully, but evidently they aren't.
We are going to leave it there. That was the voice of Daniel Lazar. Daniel joined us from New York. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.